Hello, everyone. My name is Leif, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Michael will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Michael. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, doesn't wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Grant will read the steps.
I am Grant. I'm an alcoholic. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for our knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Amy G. will read the traditions.
Thank you. The 12 traditions. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those who serve. 10. To those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Michael.
Hello, my name is Michael. I'm an alcoholic. It is an honor and a privilege to be alive and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today. And I want to thank Duncan for asking me to speak. It's always an honor to be able to serve in my home group. And I would love to welcome and thank the newcomer for being here tonight. And I pray that you have the gift of desperation as I did when I walked into these rooms. You know, not everybody walks in here with that. I was certainly blessed to have that. And, you know, I don't know anyone who walks into these rooms happy. I certainly was not happy when I walked in here. I was lonely, miserable, and spiritually bankrupt, and I just wanted to die. And I was too chicken to do it. I was too afraid to kill myself, so I figured, why not come to AA? And, you know, not what I get from Alcoholics Anonymous today is an opportunity to live. This is a bridge back to life, and for that, I am truly grateful. And Alcoholics Anonymous is not a program for people who want it. It's not a program for people who need it. It's a program for people who do it. And you're not going to get sober unless you do it. And I know that works for me. I need to remember that on a daily basis. I need to take certain actions every day to maintain my spiritual condition. You know, and it's really just simple stuff that seems radical to us because we have backwards thinking. I'll tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. You know, I grew up in a very strict Italian Catholic household. It was very violent. It was just not a fun place to be, and I definitely grew up with a distorted sense of self. And I still carry that today, but it's a lot less than it ever has been. And, you know, I didn't have many friends growing up. I didn't know how to relate to humanity. I honestly thought humanity was God's greatest mistake. I didn't know what this was all about, nor was I ever going to find out, I thought. And, you know, being raised very religious, I thought, you know, to do these things. I would go to church, I would pray, I would do all this stuff, and my life wasn't improving. And I thought, well, you know, who needs God? God doesn't work. Or if there is a God, God isn't listening. So, you know, I don't know what to put my faith in. So for a long time, I was just operating strictly on fear. And, you know, fear got me so far. My mind got me so far. It got me through school. It got me through high school. It didn't get me through college. But, you know, I was just restless, irritable, and discontented my whole life. And I always looked down on people who drank and did other substances. I always thought that they were weak for doing stuff like that. I thought that, you know, life is an endurance test, so just endure it. You know, you don't need all this other stuff to survive. And little did I know that I needed it. You know, I didn't take my first drink until I was 17 years old because my pride kept me away from a drink for that long. And the first drink I took was a shot of Goldschlager. And I still remember the gold flakes in the bottle and the feeling that I got when I took that drink. You know, it almost, I wouldn't say it was, but it was almost an instant release from 17 years of pain. You know, in an instant it was gone. And I thought, wow, you know, this stuff really works. You know, alcohol is a wonderful solution to alcoholism. It just has bad side effects. And, you know, I just, For the next 9 years, I just thought, this is what I have to do to exist in life, and that's what I did. Alcohol made me relax, it made me be able to talk to women, it made me be able to fit into the world as I saw it. And in the beginning, there were no consequences. It was fun, and I sincerely hope that everybody in this room had some fun while drinking. You know, I know I did. There was just nothing was going wrong, so I didn't see any problem with it. And I thought alcohol, you know, drinking was a social thing. I thought it was just, you know, this is what people do. You know, they've been doing it since the beginning of time. So what's the big deal today if, you know, I continue to drink? And slowly but surely, alcohol, you know, my alcoholism progressed, and I went to college. And when I got to college, I fell in with a group of people that their alcoholism was much further along than mine. And I thought, this is how you drank. I thought you drank hard and fast, and you didn't have any regard for people's well-being. I drove drunk all the time. I just thought that, you know, this is it. Life was just one big bender, and it seemed to work for a while. And eventually alcohol turned on me. My parents wouldn't allow me to leave college, so I took it into my own hands and failed out because I couldn't take it anymore. So I went into the workforce, and in the workforce I fixed elevators, and I still do today. And it's not exactly a good idea to fix elevators and be drunk at the same time. But that's what I did, and by the grace of God, I'm not dead. By the grace of God, other people are not dead because of my alcoholism. And, you know, certainly all of us are here today because of the grace of God. And, you know, like I said, I didn't believe in humanity. I thought humanity was a joke. And the only thing that I thought was an answer to this mistake was animals. You know, I always had animals. I always had pets. And I always felt that they were the centering point in my life. And even, you know, that didn't stop me. One hot August night, I had two dogs, and it was thundering out, and they don't like the noise. So one of them was going crazy, running around. And, you know, I was sitting in my parents' basement drinking by myself, because that's what I did. And I heard my dog yelp like I never heard it yelp before. And it started raining, and I ran out, and the dog was lying in the kennel dying from heat stroke. 2 days later, we put the dog to sleep because, you know, I'm an irresponsible alcoholic and I couldn't take care of living things. And I thought, well, who's next? You know, is it me? Is it another human being? What's going to die next? Or how far is this going to go? And, you know, I was scared. I was scared for my life. And that's why I say, I hope you have the gift of desperation, because I started coming to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first meeting I went to was the Mustard Seed, 11:30 in the morning, and I had 4 days. I didn't hear a word anybody said, but I knew I was in a safe place. I got a sponsor, and a sponsor in this group, my first sponsor, Raphael, who has now moved to Florida, and he quickly took me through the steps. And I mean, I will say that because of him, because of this group, because of this program, you know, it really was a magical experience. You know, I felt for the first time inner peace, that something was waking up inside of me. And that's God. That's nothing else except God. God was waking up inside of me, and I had the will to live. I never had that before. And Alcoholics Anonymous has really just, it's just an amazing program, you know. The more I study it, the more I realize how lucky we are to be alive. And, you know, I listen to Joe and Charlie a lot. I love Joe and Charlie. And, you know, I love when Charlie says, he's like, you know, who's more lucky than us? Who gets to live two lifetimes in one? You know, we have, you know, in step seven, we get to take opposite actions of our character defects. And, you know, I was an active alcoholic who caused a lot of damage. And today I'm a recovered alcoholic who has a very nice life, has, you know, still has my job, I have my health, I have friends, I have family. I can look the world in the eye and not be afraid and run away anymore. And what summed it up for me in my first 90 days was I was driving to work, driving down the West Side Highway, and I was listening to a CD, and on the CD was the 23rd Psalm, and the 23rd Psalm performed by the band Megadeth. And there's a line in the Psalm that says, "He leadeth us in the path of righteousness for his name's sake." None of us are here because we deserve it, because we've earned it, because we've done anything to be here. I mean, we're here today because we take certain actions, but we're here strictly on the grace of God. God has put us here, and we have the wonderful opportunity to give this to other sick and suffering alcoholics. Who's luckier than us? I don't know anybody who's luckier than us. And it's my sincere hope that if you're new, you'll stay, you'll find a sponsor. I need sponsees, so come and see me after the meeting. And, I love the Atlantic Group, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and you have all saved my life. And I hope in return I've done something to help you. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Katie.
I'm Katie, I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Jen for asking me to speak. I'm so nervous. The Atlantic Group's my home group. My sponsor is James. If you have any complaints, he's right there in row 9. You can just go talk to him. My sobriety date is May 17, 2004, and I'm working on 9 and living in 10, 11, and 12. And I can honestly say from the beginning, from as far back as I can remember, I always remember hating myself, absolutely hating myself, and hating who I was. And when I was a kid, about 10 years old, I had these huge glasses, and I was fat, and I was that kid in the class who always said, "You forgot to give us homework," the pencils would go flying, and I'd hate me too and I did. And so sometime around the age of 10, I discovered my parents' white Zinfandel wine in the box in the refrigerator. And I would come home from school, and my parents got home at 6, I got home at 3. I would come home from school, I would pour myself a glass of wine, and I would watch cartoons. And I can say I looked forward to cartoon time all day long. And it's a progressive disease, and as I got older, the only thing that changed, I didn't drink with other people, and my parents didn't know I was drinking, the only thing that changed was the size of the cup. And when I was in high school, I went to bed at 8 o'clock at night, and my parents would always brag to their friends, "Oh, we're so proud of Katie, she goes to bed at 8 o'clock at night," and actually I was passing out. And so I didn't do well in high school, needless to say, but by the grace of God, I found out late in my high school career that I am a great singer. So I got into a music conservatory on a scholarship, and I was the only one with a D-minus grade point average in my whole school that got a scholarship. And I went to college, and right out of college, I went to college, I lost 60 pounds, I got contact lenses, I felt great. I still hated myself, but I was able to hide that fact, and I was starting to drink with other people. And when I got out of college, I went out for opera auditions, and I got the first job I applied for, and it was a great job. I worked for about 15 hours a week. I wore beautiful dresses. I got a full paycheck, and it was wonderful, and I got free booze. And my contract was up after 2 years, and I decided that they weren't respecting me enough and they weren't giving me big enough roles. So I decided that I was just going to quit the opera because, after all, I can get any job I want. I got the first one out of the gate, and all the jobs dried up, and I could not get an opera job. And so it was around that time that I was at home, unemployed, watching TV, that these ads for New England Tractor Trailer Training School came on. And the jingle went, "New England Tractor Trailer Training School, this is where you should be." And I thought, yes, that sounds glamorous, So instead of going out for more glamorous opera jobs, I decided I would be this glamorous truck driver. And I went out to get and if you have any misconceptions that driving a truck is glamorous, I'm here to tell you, it sucks. It's awful. And And I did a lot of drinking during that time, and I busted up a lot of vans, and I really started to become really irresponsible, and I started to, lose touch with reality. And I moved in with this a man I'd met, and we started this relationship, and we started drinking a lot together, and you know, I thought I had it pretty good. We would go to the bar, we would come home, I would go to work. We would go to the bar, I would come home, we would go to work. You know, I used to do great things, like go out and sing for people, and I would do, you know, operas and do all this amazing stuff. But then all of a sudden I went to the bar, I went home, and I would drink. And that was started to become my life. And it was around this time that I got a call from my dad, and he said, your mother's very sick, and she's in the hospital, and you need to go see her. So I went to go see my mom in the hospital, and I found out that she had alcoholic pancreatitis, and that she was dying, and I had no idea. I knew she drank a lot. I had no idea how much she drank, but I didn't know she was that sick. And for a long time, she annoyed me, she got on my nerves, I didn't pay any attention to her, and she died. And for the first time in my life, I didn't know what to do with myself. And my boyfriend broke up with me right after, and I just kind of, the world fell out from underneath me, and I kind of used that as an excuse to really start drinking. And I started to think about my mom and how she started drinking when she was much older than I had started drinking, and I got really scared, and I said, I always had this idea in the back of my mind that, you know, I know I drink a lot, and I think I'll get it under control someday. And when my mom died, I said, this is it. This is the time I have to get it under control. And so I told myself, I'm only going to drink 2 drinks a night from now on. And I tried it, and I couldn't do it. And I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified, because there's this part in the big book, and it talks about how Bill goes to a cemetery, and there's a tombstone that says, this soldier died from drinking. Even though he was a good soldier, he still died from drinking, and it scared Bill. And I saw my own mother die that way, and I was terrified, and I couldn't stop drinking. And my life got very dark. I quit all of my jobs, and I just kind of sat in my apartment and drank all the time. And my life went back to what it was in high school, except I didn't have anything. And so this happened for 1.5 years. I drank like that after my mom died. And, you know, by some miracle, I got a call about an audition. I went to go sing for them. I wasn't quite right for the part, but they offered me a role in the chorus. And I didn't want to do it because I was not a choir singer. I was a soloist. But I took the job because they said, it's $500. I said, okay. And I went to my first rehearsal, and my friend was there from college, and she was the one in college that everybody worried about, because she would get so drunk, we'd pour her into a cab, and we all shake our heads and go, wow, Holly should really go to AAA. And, you know, we worried about her. And she was at this rehearsal I was at, and she got my part. And she looked great, and she sounded great. And I went up to her, I said, you know, it's Katie, how are you doing? What have you been doing with yourself? You look fantastic. And she looked at me and she said, I joined Alcoholics Anonymous and my life has never been better. And at that moment, the words came out of my mouth, I think I need a meeting. And I was mortified. I had no intention of saying that, but something inside me placed that in me to say that. And, you know, she took me to a meeting, and here I am today. It's been 4 years and I haven't had a drink since. And, I can honestly tell you that I do have a life beyond my wildest dreams, because my wildest dreams are that I have a husband, a gorgeous husband, a ton of money, and a great opera career, and I don't have any of those things. I'm nowhere near having any of those things, but I'm happy today, and that's the part that's beyond my wildest dreams, because I always thought I would need those things to be happy. And the ironic part is, if I had had those things back then, I wouldn't have been happy anyway. It still wouldn't have been enough for me. But, you know, I've had the spiritual experience that the book talks about. And I came in, and I did not believe in God. And when I came in, I started taking small actions. I started showing up on time. I started doing things like calling other people when I didn't want to. You know, I started working again. And by taking those small changes, I was able to have a complete personality change. And it was slow, and at times it was painful, but it did happen. And I'm still so nervous. I have so much hope in my life today. And that's, you know, back in the day, hope was gone. And I saw life as, you know, you live, you die, you turn to dirt, and that's it. And today I see that, like, I can be useful today, and I can help other people. I never cared if I was useful before. I never cared if I could help anybody before. And today, that's what I love to do most, and that's what I crave, helping people, because it just makes you feel so good. And I have sponsees today, and it's amazing when I can watch my sponsees, and, you know, I have such a hard time getting things sometimes, and I watch them go through these things, and I see them get them, and it reaffirms my sobriety. It really shows me that I need to keep trying, and I need to keep going. And I have friends, and I see them go through hard things, and it shows me that I can keep going, and it shows me, you know, what a power example people can be. The woman who 12-stepped me, she was not going out on an AA call. She was just showing up at her job, doing what she was supposed to do. And I saw something in her that I really admired. And today I try to do that. In all my affairs, I try to be a good person. I try to practice the principles. I try to be loving and accepting and kind. And it's not always easy, but it's progress, not perfection. And as long as I keep trying, God does not make too hard of terms with those who seek him. So, you know, I'm always so sad that I never was able to do my amends to my mother before she passed away. But today, you know, if somebody walks in and they come up to me and they say, you know, I'm really scared, I have kids, I don't know if I can get sober, I can tell them, you know, I used to be miserable and I used to hate myself, but I don't today, and I can show you how I did it, and maybe I can give a little bit back. So thank you so much.
And tonight, our main speaker is Rich.
Good evening. My name is Rich. I'm an alcoholic. This is like the Woodstock of Alcoholics Anonymous here, man. Jeez, gosh. Got a lot of action going on in this group, too. I was hoping I could get a plug-in for my book, maybe, you know? Lots of stuff happening at the Atlantic Group, you know? I want to thank Katie and Michael for sharing before me. Katie mentioned the magic word. As much as I would like to tell you how wonderful I am and how unique my speaking is, I have a message up here tonight that hopefully will somehow or another instill hope inside of some suffering woman or man who has lost all hope and doesn't think that he or she can ever feel what it feels like again. And that's the magic word. If I had one word to describe what Alcoholics Anonymous gave me as a 23-year-old, very sick young man, it would be hope. You know, I have a friend, Peter, who belongs to this group, and the first time that I was here a few months back had been the first time in a number of years I had been to this group, and it was the Midtown group. I don't want to offend anybody, but us guys in Queens used to come into the Midtown group because you had the best-looking women in AA, you know, and we used to love your dances, and my sponsor said you can't make poo where you eat, so you got to go into Manhattan and stay out of Queens, you know. So we came in here all dutied up, you know, and sober, and we had a great time, lots of fun. And if I owe anybody an amends, I'm here tonight to give it to you, I promise. Anyway, I have a very swift, rapid progression. I don't identify with people who drank going to school, because I didn't go to school. I can't imagine how anybody can drink alcoholically and go to school and get A's, no less, you know. I had no tolerance for it. I've read the Big Book probably 1,000 times. I couldn't quote a page from you. If you sat me down now and if you read it back to me in my ear, I'd have a problem quoting it to you, you know. I store information in a very unique way, and I've been self-taught in many ways in my life. And I just process things the way God has allowed me and shown me to process them, you know. I am not a Big Book thumper, and yet it's my favorite book. It's a very personal book to me. It means different things at different times. There's no way I'm going to give to you out of that book what I get from it. Hopefully, if you're reading it, you can get from it what recovery is all about, you know, to each his own. I wish you the best with it, you know. I come from a large Irish wannabe Catholic family. I hated religion. I hated authority. You know, and probably the theme of me speaking tonight might be that particular word, hate, which is a very, very strong word. I hate that word, you know. And by the time I was 11 or 12 years old, I was filled with hatred. My father was an alcoholic who also died of pancreatic cancer. actually committed suicide due to the progression of that disease and the amount of drugs that he had to take over a nine-year period. He was supposed to have only lived 6 months, but he suffered tremendously and wound up taking his own life. So through this disease of alcoholism, my father committed suicide. We lived in a place called Coney Island. Coney Island's a magical place for me. I spent maybe 7 or 8 years there of my life, my first 7 or 8 years. It's embedded in me. It's probably the most joyous place I can ever go back to in both memory and physically be there. I have 3 children who go to Coney Island 2 or 3 times a year. I live in Long Beach now. So I have handed down that tradition. It's a magical place for me. It was a magical place. I was brought up with 5 older siblings, 2 younger siblings, and everything was happening in my house beautifully until I was about 3.5 years old, and this guy called Daddy came home from Sing Sing after doing 3.5, nearly 4 years for armed robbery, and my dad was a full-blown alcoholic, a violent alcoholic, compulsive gambler, and we very, very rarely saw or seen anything prosperous, anything educational, anything indicative of accomplishment or achievement in our home. We had no books in our house. We had, you know, hand-me-down furniture in our home. Rare was it that we never had a phone. Our electricity was usually running through somebody else's apartment into our apartment. My dad stripped us of every penny my mom had. We were on welfare most of our lives, and we got a welfare check back then on the 16th and the 1st of every month. And around the 12th or the 13th, my mom's, you know, spirit would be flying because the check would be nearing. And most times my dad would intercept the check and he'd take it, and we would have to therefore go and Catholic Charities and social services and store credit, delicatessen credit. My mom and my siblings didn't go to A&P or BOHAC. I'm 54, three years old, so you might not recognize some of these names, you know, but we didn't do weekly shopping or anything like that. We lived on Sweet 16 donuts. We lived on, you know, whatever was available according to the amount of dollars that were in the house, that's what we ate. And we went many a nights and days without a healthy meal, you know. But I can tell you one thing. My mom was the cleanest broke woman in this world, you know. My mom did everything with Ajax, with Clorox. My mom washed everything with Clorox except dishes. My mom killed cockroaches. We were the only one. We lived in projects. We were the only apartment that didn't have cockroaches in the building. And you'd hear, how do you do that, Alice? How do you do that? And she says, I use Clorox. That's how I do it. I spread it around the perimeter of the house, and I don't get any roaches or anything like that. And you can eat off Alice's floors, you know. She was incredible. But this disease does not play, doesn't care about Clorox, doesn't care about kids, doesn't care about anything. This disease will wreak havoc on your life, and it'll take every ounce of spirit that you possess that God gave you. I heard a guy say the other day he wasn't born with ambition. I think we're all born with ambition. We're all born with incredible, incredible light and gifts. This disease will steal it from you in an instant. I came from the womb into this disease. Had I never picked up a drink or another substance, I would have needed this fellowship as desperately as I needed it as a result of my drinking. I hated my dad, like I said. I learned to hate very, very early in life. I hated my dad with a passion. I saw him beat my mom up. I saw him destroy a family. I saw him beat my older brother up. I saw him deprive us of everything. And I didn't know what he was doing at that time. The physical stuff I was witness to, I can comprehend that. I can embrace that and say there's something seriously wrong here. You know, but it's the other messages that you get through the alcoholic mind, you know, the conflicting messages, the behavior and being told something else was happening. I have no problems with why my sense of reality was distorted and warped. You know, I know exactly why, and the origin of that is my mom and is my dad. You know, I put no blame on this, but there's certainly an origin of this disease in my life. And if anybody tries to tell me to let go of that stuff, I have to pray that he gets a real good sponsor and does the work that we're supposed to do in this place, you know. So the first person I ever hated was my dad, and I was never going to be like my dad. Never, ever going to be like my dad. He used to drink a bottle of beer called Rangold. A lot of you probably remember Rheingold, you know. I used to see life through that brown bottle of Rheingold, you know. I used to take those bottles back and get money in Molly's candy store and buy pickles out of a barrel with it, you know, and penny bubble gum and penny candy. And I used to get him the Daily Mirror, and I'd be coming up to this guy hoping that he'd have another two or three bottles so I can have the deposit and get something. But I hated him. I wanted nothing to do with him. And I started running from him after I caught a couple of the beatings from him at a very early age. I started avoiding my dad at 6 or 7 years old. You know, I was never going to be like him. I have to tell you that by the age 10, I had left school. I wanted nothing to do with school. I hated religious instructions. I hated blacks. I hated Jews. I hated my father. I hated religion. I hated everything. I didn't want anything to do with anyone. I hated Chinese, Japanese. I hated everything by the age 10 years old. And for a boy to hate that much at 10 years old is very, very sick and very sad, you know. And I had this innocent spirit in me that was questioning that stuff even at that time. What the hell is going on here? Why am I feeling like this? I felt inadequate in every aspect of my life. Self-contempt and hate, just like Katie, at a tremendously young age, too young. To ever even, for a child to even have the thought of feeling like that is sick, you know. Terribly sad, you know. By the time I was 10 years old, I had hated so much that I started acting out everywhere I went, and I got into a lot of trouble. I was to visit a place called Spofford Youth House. It was the most notorious juvenile correctional facility in this country, in the South Bronx. And that was the first place. The first time I sat in front of a judge was because my parents couldn't deal with me anymore. Can you imagine? A judge put me away with my father standing just on the side of me. You know, I could not adhere to supervision. Isn't that a joke, huh? Now, I had some dialogue in some of my writings with this judge, and I told him a little bit about this guy beside me who had summoned me here for you to take care of me, and the judge made a very, very quick, you know, reversal of that decision and talked to this guy about what the problem of this 10-year-old boy was, you know. But I disconnected and detached from my dad and my mom and society pretty much at that age. And I went on a rampage for the next 13 years. My first drunk was was from a bottle of Chianti. I was about 10 and a half years old. And I blacked out, you know. And I don't know if I liked blacking out or if I didn't like blacking out, but I blacked out, you know. The last thing I remember, I think I puked over this guy Keith Limbeck's shoulder, and I was out like a light, you know. And I woke up the next day. My dad, you know, probably punished me. I don't remember. I don't remember exactly what he did. I'd like to say that he kicked the hell out of me and all this. I don't know what he did, you know. I don't even think he really cared all that much, you know. But in the next 5 years, I witnessed my older brother, John, who was a tremendous athlete, very well known throughout Brooklyn, had people looking at him to play basketball, great point guard, tremendous baseball player, always in uniform, you know. I had three beautiful older sisters, you know. None of us had a high school education. Nobody ever got a high school education. My sister went on to get a master's degree. She left a big job, and she did that at 50 years old. But none of us got education. We were all separated from lots of movings around and so on, you know, and we were separated. I separated from my sisters and brothers quite a bit, and it was very sad, and it was heartbreaking for all of us, you know, to be pulled apart from one another. And this is an extreme, you know, but this is the disease of alcoholism. This is my story. This is what this disease does, you know. It doesn't play. And it separated us, really, you know, in a very harsh way, you know, and humiliated us. My dad's, you know, drinking, you know, humiliated us, cashing bum checks in the neighborhood, you know, walking into stores. Hey, Davis, where's your old man? He cashed another bum check. I used to want to say to the guy, you know, you're pretty stupid cashing the guy's checks. You cash, you know, 3, 4, 5 checks. You keep cashing them. What's the problem with you, you know? A codependent. I was 10. He was codependent, this guy. You know, I questioned issues like that. But anyway, I went on to drink pretty steadily. And I'm a 60s boy, so I can tell you that there were other things coinciding with that. But I loved booze. I loved booze. And by the time I was 17 or 18 years old, I was drinking booze, you know, pretty much on a daily basis, with a little bit of time out for something else. But I loved booze. And I got drunk, and I got angry, and I got violent. And who did I turn into? I turned into my old man. I turned into my dad. That's who I turned into. Everything that I hated about my dad, I wound up doing, and some. And I hated it, and hated it, and hated myself. And as the disease progressed, of course, I became more violent. I became more troublesome in and out of jail. I was arrested numerous times, you know, and I couldn't stop myself. You know, one of the outstanding frustrations in my life as a teenager and a young boy as well was I got in contact with powerlessness at a very, very early age. Because we were brought up in poverty, I used to see kids going to school with, you know, they'd go to Glee Club and they'd have their guitars, they'd have their, you know, whatever instrument they played. And I used to feel so like, I pray, God, please, why can't I get one of those things, you know? Just one of those instruments. Let me just play one of those instruments. Let me have one, please. And it just went unanswered. And I thought, you know, it wouldn't, you know, it wasn't even heard, you know? One of the things that probably saved my life was this thing called the British Invasion. I loved music. I began listening to music at an early age, and it became my poetry, it became my literature, it became my education. I can tell you anything about music trivia. I remember everything. I have this encyclopedia up here about pop rock music and even music prior to that because of my mom. I danced all my life. I love to dance. I'm a good dancer, you know. I grabbed onto certain things that I didn't have to go to school for, things that came from inside of me. But the music primarily turned me onto this thing called romance, you know, And I loved music and I loved romance, and it sort of shifted me. I heard Roy Orbison sing Pretty Woman, and I don't know about any of you guys, but that sort of moved me around a little bit, you know. I didn't need a drink to go talk to a girl. I don't know how that worked out. Maybe it's my astrological sign or something, but I certainly was no virtue of my own, I don't think, you know. Something shifted, you know. And I only bring that up because it you know, these little things that you find along the way that are part of your salvation. I look in hindsight and I see, wow, yeah, there's God, there he is, that's right. I suddenly realize in many instances what God was doing for me. And in a very loving, tender way, because quite frankly, had I gotten what I truly deserved, I wouldn't be here. And I don't play games with things like that. I deserve, I don't deserve, I'm here for a reason. I'm here for a reason. I'm shining some sort of light for somebody as the person who's shown a light for me when I walk into these wonderful, magical doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. So, and I'll cut through this, and I'll just say by the age 17, I had liver disease. By the age 17, I had a long, long record of criminal activity. By the age 19, I was facing life in prison. By the age 23, I was homeless, facing life in prison, liver disease, nowhere to go. And I had nothing in front of me, nothing behind me. I had warrants for my arrest. I had just come off a four-year blackout, geographics from 19 to 23, to and from Florida two times, Suffolk County, waking up in women's clothing stores, trying on women's clothing. I was all over the place and lots of trouble, you know, acting out. Being thrown out of every bar that I was thrown, that I was coming into. I had a fight with a man one night, and I hit him. He fell. He broke his skull. They stitched him up. A week later, he went into a coma with blood clots on his brain, nearly died. And I just drank. Just give me drink. Just give me some alcohol. Let me just stay in my coma because I can't deal with anything. All of that hatred had grown even greater. The hatred, though, had now turned into fear and paranoia. I wanted to commit suicide, you know. I don't know why I didn't. I wanted to commit suicide in Rikers Island. I wanted to commit suicide when I was 12 years old. I wanted to commit suicide at 10 years old. I wanted to commit suicide. Isn't that just a lovely option when stuff isn't going right? What a convenient option, you know. I'm not made for suicide, you know. Had I wanted to do it, I was drunk enough and desperate enough many a times where I could have. I went to this, I came out of a blackout July 4th, 1977. I went into an annual family party that I wasn't welcome to. My family wasn't welcome to. It was my cousin's party. They owned a bar in Woodside. And whenever we came to the bar, my two brothers, particularly my two older brothers, they just said, no. And I conned them into letting me in, and 20 minutes later, I'd be carried out by a couple of bouncers, you know. I couldn't handle my booze, you know. I was not a good drinker, you know. I had gone into a blackout July 4th, 1977, and I woke up on August 17th, 1977. And that was the summer of the New York City blackout, which I was blacked out in. I remember nothing about it. The paper read that the king is dead, Elvis is dead. I said, oh, my God. How the hell did that happen? Elvis is dead. I had a very, very serious, you know, German guy banging on my door for 6 weeks' rent. 6 weeks went by real, real quickly, and he wanted his money. Make a long story short, he evicted me. And it was a series of events that occurred within the next 10 days. I had gone out on another 10-day blackout and wound up at my sister's house, and my sister threw me out at 6 o'clock in the morning and said, I don't trust you anymore in my house, Richard. You have to leave. She said, my family and I are going fishing today. I said, fishing? People still fish? I said, fishing, how normal that sounds. I would love to go fishing. I was 23 years old. I hadn't fished in quite a while. How normal and wonderful that sounded. And here a sister of mine, my beautiful sister Kathleen, who just absolutely beautiful woman, and joined at the hip, both of us, for our entire lives, didn't want me in a home no more. And I was a kid that she used to chase in the streets to try to help and get them out of trouble, you know. And God bless her for throwing me out, because it forced me into calling up this wonderful place called Alcoholics Anonymous, which I did, you know. And that was August 28, 1977. I had gathered up about 70 or so days, went out and used and drank one night, and came back. And November 8th is my sober date. I can go through a number of things, you know, to tell you how much time do I have left. Am I doing good here? All right. I like to respect the autonomy of each group, you know, and that's my appreciation that I do that, you know, for you having me here. I did some wonderful things. I had some great stuff happen. I heard a guy share the other day that, you know, he doesn't know what he's got really, but it's so, so far beyond his expectations of himself, you know. And isn't that enough, you know? Isn't that incredibly enough? You know, I say this with great sincerity, that if my life were to end today, I'm way ahead of the game. I'm not even afraid of death anymore. In fact, sometimes I say, come on, don't worry about it. I'm ready for that too, you know, because I don't really hang on to too much anymore, you know, that used to frighten me, although there are matters of the heart and places in which I'm vulnerable that still frighten the hell out of me. But I come to this fellowship and I work my program. I have a wonderful sponsor. I have three beautiful children. I have a daughter who's 20, going to be 23 years old. She's around the same age I was when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. She's a college student. I have twin boys, 19. One's out in University of Arizona. And that is by no virtue of my own. That is Alcoholics Anonymous. That is you people. He's a wonderful boy. He has a twin brother who I'm with on a daily basis, you know. My children always know where I am. Doesn't matter if I know where they are. They always know where I am. I never knew my dad. I never knew where my dad was, you know. I spent probably maybe a couple of hours quality time with my dad my whole life, you know. You know, I talked about a lot about hate, you know, as a young boy, and I grew up part of these steps. They also helped me with my prejudices and my racism, because I was on the streets for a long time, you know, and I got into a lot of trouble, had a lot of fights in jail, fights on basketball courts. I play basketball, and it's a predominantly black world there, and I used to just wait. I couldn't wait to get on the court and vent some stuff, because I had issues in jail that I just wanted to get back at people. I didn't like the Jews because they lived across from the projects. They frowned upon us, people in the projects, and I love a woman today who's an absolutely incredible Jewish woman. These steps have helped me in all of those areas, you know, have taken all of the sickness and the diseased part of that out of me, where I can work on that and I can say, hey, it's not part of who I am today. I can give it up, you know. I've learned how to do that through the steps, you know. I have a great relationship with most people in my life, you know. And I give back to this wonderful fellowship everything that it ever asks me for, and I do whatever I can, whether it asks or not, you know. And I come to this fellowship. I fought a bout of cancer in the last 4 years. I was on got some serious radiation treatments in my head and my neck. I fought a bout of hepatitis. I had hepatitis from age 17, 37 years. And because of this fellowship and this program keeping me sober, I never had a problem with my hepatitis C. It was only because of my immune system being compromised from the cancer. My doctors recommended that I go on interferon. And God saw fit to give me the good gene type, because I would never have done 12 months on that stuff. I only needed to do 6 months. I was in bed for medicated for a real, real long time, and in a serious depression. I've been through a hell of a lot, but that's the way it goes, man. That's just the way it goes. I'm not unique in that. It's nothing. I don't have to wave a flag or a banner or get any kudos for that stuff. I have to do that stuff. That's life on life's terms, you know. I love my life today. I don't have a lot of things, but I got much more than I could ever have bargained for or asked for when I came into the rooms, you know. I did go back to school. I have a hard time with that because I ran a business. I got my first college credits. I think I was 49 or maybe even 51 years old, actually, you know. It took me about 27 to 28 years to actually settle in, and the fear of school, the surroundings of school, that structure, you know, I just absolutely hated, you know. And I had an English teacher told me that I was in the top 7% of any writing she has ever read in the 20 or so years that she's been an English professor. And I says, what the hell does that mean? Why didn't you pick 10%? What do you mean 7%? What happened to 10%? When do you come off at 7%? I don't get that, you know. This is where my mind goes, you know. But, you know, I've developed a lot of things that I didn't expect to over the years. My sponsor went out. How am I doing on time, buddy? 5 minutes. My first sponsor went out after about my first 7 or so years, and he went out and drank. And I was absolutely devastated, but I didn't realize it at that time, because we go into this let's take care of him mode. And I began to call him and try to take care of him. And 20 years went by before I picked another sponsor. I couldn't find another sponsor. I didn't realize it. And it's only the last couple of years that he doesn't return my phone calls and doesn't want to be active in my life the life of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I have a wonderful sponsor today. And it took a lot of years to recognize that and realize that, hey, man, you know, sponsors, they're so special. So, so, so special. Yet, if you don't love your sponsor, then there's an issue there, man, you know. And I love the sponsor I have today. You know, Paul McCartney says on one of his songs in the Abbey Road album, he says, oh, that magic feeling, nowhere to go. I thank God that that magic feeling was bestowed upon me in 1977, because I had nowhere to go. And Alcoholics Anonymous was a phone call away. And I put that dime, it was a dime back then, in that phone, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had two wonderful men pick me up. Between the two of them, I think they were about 250 years old, you know. And they brought me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life has been absolutely incredible since then. My wonderful mom died 22 years sober because of this fellowship and program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sisters, I am pretty much the one that they go to. I am the one that they know is going to be there if they need any help. We get in touch with Richard. And my kids, I coach my kids in sports. I coach in Long Beach sports. I'm called coach by a lot of the kids. I still play ball competitively today. I'm in great shape. I was playing football at 50 when I was diagnosed with cancer. And I'm saying, oh, man, how am I going to get radiation and play at the same time? How am I going to do that, you know? This is the way it goes. My father, I wish... I have a picture of him tonight, and I had for a special reason. My father was a World War II veteran, fought under Patton in the Battle of the Bulge. My father was a real handsome, smart Irishman, you know, very proud of a lot of stuff. The disease destroyed him. It just took the air from his lungs, the feet out from his body, and just made the man go in such a way. He died in a welfare hotel. We were living in and out of welfare hotels for quite a number of years. You know, but I truly, truly am proud. I got pictures. My mom and dad never had a picture of any of us. I have pictures of my family all over my apartment. I have a library in my home. My children never see me without reading a book. I am always reading or writing or doing something constructive or educational for myself. You know, I'm in the midst of trying to get at least one piece of work published and another one that I just finished up. These are dreams and aspirations that I have, you know. If they do get published, well, thank God. If they don't, thank God I was able to write them anyway, you know. If you're new or just coming back to this fellowship, give yourself wholeheartedly. Surrender. Surrender. Give it up, man, because there's nowhere to go after this. Truly, there's nowhere to go. I have, unfortunately, with time, seen a lot of beautiful men and women go to their graves holding on to this disease, not thinking that it was for them, this thing called recovery and sobriety. You know, let it go. Surrender. Break down. Cry. Do whatever you have to do. Pull temper tantrums on the floor. You could dance naked in the rafters. In fact, our second tradition and third tradition says if you want to do that, you go right ahead. We'll give you our numbers. You can call us anyway. You know, so, you know, do whatever you have to do to keep that drink out of your system. One day at a time, and only one day at a time, 1 minute at a time if you must, you know. And don't ever, ever forget that if you do, and if you are able to get that, well, then you must give it back immediately, if not sooner, to the person you see next suffering. I want to thank all my posse over there. My sponsor Marcus said I better mention him. And I'll mention my friend Bernie, my wonderful girlfriend Sharon, and my wonderful friend Richie and his girlfriend Beth. Do I get them, everybody in here? Anybody else want me to mention their name? Anybody? Anyway, listen, I am so grateful. Thank you, Helen, so much for having me share my strength, hope, and experience. And God bless you all.